you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson back on the show because he returns to discuss his book, The Soviet Experiment, Challenging the Apologist for Communist Tyranny. Dr. Johnson is an author of several books, including The Third Rome, Holy Russia, Tsarism and Orthodoxy, and also Russian Populist, The Political Thought of Vladimir Putin. His website is the Russian Orthodox Medievalist at rushjournal.com. Is that correct?
.org.
.org. I'm sorry. I wrote that down wrong. .org. Rushjournal.org.
That's what it was.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, I changed it when Matt Parrott put it together.
Okay.
.com is worth like 10 grand or something, so we went with .org.
Okay. Well, this book, The Soviet Experiment. Now, you wrote this sort of to, I guess, challenge big myths about the Soviet Union and the revolutionary period and also the Cold War, and also to provide a revisionist history of these things. What are the major points of this book?
Well, these have come from essays I've put together over the years, but they're substantially rewritten. I've put together, you know, the theses that I argue is I've been arguing for ages. The big one is that the Communist Party at any level, at any time, for any reason, for any purpose, ever gave a damn about the working class of the captive nations. If there's any country that exploited its working class, it was Russia. It was the Soviet Union. They banned labor unions. And I mentioned the fact that, you know, they were tons of you know, Russia was never a capitalist country. You had, you know, the Labor Brotherhood of the Holy Cross. You had all the Artels. You had the peasant communes. You had monastic labor brotherhoods all over the place. These were real functional socialist institutions. And, you know, these were all destroyed. It was one of the first things they did when Tito took power in Yugoslavia. If there was ever a good communist, Tito comes the closest because he wasn't nearly as tyrannical as the rest of them were. I mean, he had prison camps and everything, but it was never anything like USSR or North Korea. And when he actually created worker control over industry, which he was the model for, he threatened with invasion. The church was always despised capitalism. But so the second thing was the notion of worker or proletarian or any labor related term isn't what we think, because they called Jacob Schiff a proletarian, but some poor priest from Ukraine was a capitalist exploiter. So these terms never meant what we thought. And yet historians, even historians on our side, take them at their word. They never mean that. They simply mean a worker is someone who supported the party, period. That's what a proletarian was. It had nothing to do with their position in society, whether they were wealthy or not, because the Jewish founders of the Communist Party all come from middle or upper middle class backgrounds. So terms like worker and everything, this has to do with supporting the party, and it didn't matter how rich you were. The third thing is that Trotsky, Lenin, and Stalin were identical. They didn't differ on anything. The only reason that they had any differential had to do with the Jewish question. Now, Stalin was not an anti-Semite. Stalin never disliked the Jews. When he purged the party, of course, they were all Jews to begin with. So it was really hard to avoid purging pretty much nothing but Jews when a party was at the elite level, nothing but Jewish. Essentially, the American left had a problem. They either could admit that the party was completely Jewish in its early years and accept Stalin, or they could turn Stalin into this fascist. And they chose the latter option. The old Bolsheviks were heavily Jewish. But even in Solzhenitsyn's 200 Years Together, he says it's all a phony. Stalin was never anti-Jewish. The death penalty was still on the books for any anti-Semitism in the country. The next concept is that nationalism was always banned in the USSR. Stalin was never a nationalist. These are wild exaggerations. Russian nationalism was banned by the USSR. Anything having to do with that was banned, even during the war. And then, of course, the next thing is that the West was never anti-Bolshevik. The West always, they never had sanctions on the USSR. There was one brief period of time, I should say, after the invasion of Afghanistan. But it was very brief. But you had Jimmy Carter getting on TV saying, we're going to stop, high-level trade and whether it be steel or computers or everything else, suggesting that they were trading with them to begin with on that stuff. There were sanctions on Francisco Franco. And, of course, there are sanctions on Putin. But there were none on Stalin. There were none on Khrushchev. There were none on Andropov or any of these people. So there was a brisk trade. The Soviet economy, right up till Stalin, and even afterwards, I mean, their whole computer industry was built by the big computer firms in the 1970s. Ford, it was Henry Ford, built the largest truck plant in the world just outside of Kharkiv in eastern Ukraine. So I guess his anti-communism went out the window when he saw profits to be made, and the Ford was the model for all the Soviet cars after that. They didn't fear the USSR. They built the USSR. The electric grid was laid down by GE. The Gulag system was laid down by private prison contractors. I mean, this all comes from the West. The gold mining came from a big Alaskan company. They were never anti-USSR. They were heavily invested in it. So you have this love for the American military today, but the hatred for it during the Korean and Vietnam War, because, the U.S. is allegedly fighting communism on the one hand, but then trading and giving aid and assistance to the USSR on the other hand. And, of course, the USSR was supporting these, North Korea and North Vietnam. So the whole thing is completely phony. If there's one myth out there, it's the Cold War. And the negative Soviet rhetoric came around whenever the Soviet Union threatened to get too big. And it got too big when China fell in 49. And now they start worrying, well, they could have their own economy and cut us out of it. Because even then, they were still trading in dollars. The trade before the Sino-Soviet split of 61, they were trading in dollars. There was never any, a lot of that was rhetoric, trying to find an enemy after World War II. And, that was simple rhetoric, because if they were against the Soviet Union, they'd cut off all trade with them. And yet every major area of industry was built by Western, especially American companies, including during the Depression. Stalin, I forget which Congress it was, actually said, we're worried that because of the heavy Western investment in our country, that we're losing our independence. And that's how intense – when they were bringing over Western workers, there were all of these exchanges of students with Soviet scientists being trained in all American universities and going back to the Soviet Union. None of this was ever stopped. So that list of arguments is what holds the whole book together, that in all of these areas, everything, even some of the things that our people say, is all mythical. And especially the stuff about Stalin, that he was this anti-Semitic nationalist, was absolute nonsense. Stalin had a whole plan for a global domination and a single language and a single world government, destroying all forms of nationalism led by, you know, Moscow. And any conception of Russian nationalism was banned, even during the war. He permitted a few churches to be built, really minor stuff like that. But that's really what this book is all about. So this group of theses in a row, because this isn't a unified book necessarily. These are a series of essays. But those are the major issues that I deal with in detail.
Yeah, you're right. An empire at war with capitalism while being constructed and financed by it. Empire dedicated to socialist reconstruction of society, making sure with great effort that all forms of socialist reconstruction be destroyed as quickly as possible. You refer to the ideology of the Bolsheviks as sort of a cover or just a ruse or an instrument to seize assets, control the economy.
Well, if you could plan the economy and decide what industries get what and what's going to be produced and what isn't going to be produced, which was all centrally planned at Gauss Plan, which of course is a banker's dream, to have an economy controlled all from one place, means that you control these assets. Now, when Trotsky was killed, he had two bank accounts, and he was almost a billionaire at the time. But he won in New York City and one in Switzerland. They were hundreds of millions. I mean, he was an extremely wealthy, one of the richest men in the world by the time he was killed. Now, I don't know where that money ended up, but they discovered two bank, and none of this has been done in English yet. I think it may have been Solzhenitsyn in his 200 Years Together that mentions how rich these men were. Well, where'd the money come from? You know, this was simply the fact that they owned everything. If you can control the economy and there's no private ownership, that means the party owns everything. Well, if you control the party and the party owns everything, that means you own everything. And so these guys were always skimming from the top, and that's why their deaths, especially because, you know, because Trotsky was killed outside of the country, his bank accounts are outside of the country, and that's how we know how much he was worth. But we don't know how much the other guys are worth. But every one of them is a multimillionaire or a billionaire because they had the right to take whatever they wanted. If you could control the economy, if you could plan the economy, then you own the economy. And if you're the leader of the party, that was it. You were the richest man on the planet because the entire economy was in your hands. And I'm embarrassed that even through grad school and stuff like that, it didn't even occur to me that that would have to be the case. Just simply a simple logic. I mean, if the entire economy is planned, you own it. And so he was very close to being a billionaire by the time Trotsky was murdered. At the time, those two humongous bank accounts that were made public, but never in the American press. It was made public in the Soviet press for obvious reasons, but that's never been translated into English. So it's the whole thing was a fraud in every possible way. And so that's where their money came from. It's simply the constant exploitation of the Soviet worker.
And I guess they just take the rhetoric or slogans or speeches at face value from someone like Trotsky, just assuming what he's saying are his actual beliefs, as opposed to just a cynical ruse for him to amass a great fortune and, you know, be an oligarch.
Yeah, these guys weren't economists, you know. They were ideologues. Everything was political. Marx was an economist. He had an economic foundation. But Trotsky didn't, and Lenin didn't, and certainly Stalin and his successors didn't. Everything, you know, came from the state. They had no reason to be economists because everything was state run anyway. So everything with them was a matter of state control over industry. And once the West kind of gave them the education that they needed, they were able to take some of these things over. But as things developed in the West, they always had contact with the biggest Western giant, all the way up to the 1980s, Ronald Reagan always complained that he tried to, before his second term, put sanctions on the Soviet Union. He couldn't, because the American presidency doesn't have that power.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to tell, you know, Chevrolet where they can sell cars. You know, Chevrolet is more powerful than the government. GM is more powerful than the government is. And so he couldn't do it. And it was a huge frustration for him that he couldn't put sanctions. And the only person that was really making a big deal about this was at the Hoover Institute. The guy who wrote I can't think of his name off the top of my head.
Anthony Sutton,
who now has had a three-volume book on the connection between Wall Street and the Soviet Union. And it's nothing but primary sources. It's from internal memos, all the major investment, everything they were going to build over there going up. And the volumes are divided into eras, with the last one ending in the 80s. And so this has been constant. Every major American corporation, you know, the blue chip stocks, all had large investments in the USSR. And this is why, you know, you can't talk about a Cold War when there were no massive American investments between 1940 and 1945 in Germany. You know, the Rockefellers had something in the 30s. That was about it. So what kind of a war is this while you're trading with your alleged enemy? And of course, the Soviet Union was financed in its very early years because, you know, they were starving after the Civil War, and Woodrow Wilson made sure that they got tons of food aid. Now, maybe there they could say that they didn't really know what a Bolshevist was, which is probably true. Very few people know anything about Russia at the time. If you wanted to study the Russian language, you had to go to Harvard, and that was it. There was nowhere else to go. But, you know, you had this, and this was something that that Senator Joe McCarthy was going to talk about. One of the reasons that he was sacked as quickly as he was, he had the head of the Ukrainian Church in Exile give a speech, which I'm still struggling to find. I know what happened, but apparently it's been cut out of the record, of him talking about all the American firms that he saw setting up shop there. And I think one of the reasons that Joe McCarthy was kicked out was not because he was going to go after the army, was he had a list of all the major American blue chip stocks that were making a fortune over there, and saying, of course, you're going to have communists all over America because you have capitalists all over the USSR.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they knew. He was going to give this list and explain that they're making huge profits over there with American labor, no less. And that couldn't happen. So it's one of the biggest open secrets of the 20th century, is that there was never really any Cold War. Or at least there was certainly never any ideological war. Any empire that got that big, I mean, it could have been on British Manchesterian principles, it wouldn't have made any difference. An empire that big, especially when China fell, was going to run afoul of the U.S. eventually.
Mm-hmm.
So it had nothing to do with ideology. It had to do with the fact that they may be able to eventually cut the Americans out. Then when they threatened to do that, switch over to rubles or something like that, then all of a sudden the Soviet Union was terrible. And if you read Woodrow Wilson's speeches in the early Bolshevik period, the only time he ever condemns them is when they act like a czar. He actually uses that phrase, we have to watch these guys. They're acting just like the czars before them. So that was his only motivation for having anything negative to say about them. But even the leaders of the White Army said, we had the money. We couldn't buy a bullet from the West. Their weapons all came from captured weapons from the Reds. They had most of the czar's treasury, which was pretty big because they had a huge trade surplus. And they had this money. No one would sell them anything. That's how vehemently the West could have crushed communism. The British were right in Petersburg. The Petersburg Soviet could have been crushed 100 times over. The Japanese were willing to crush the Soviets in Siberia. They were always held back. And then, of course, World War II, which allowed Stalin to build his gulag from East Germany to North Korea. And to that, you know, Hitler couldn't figure it out. You know, he's saying, you know, how are they supporting these people? So even he was, you know, thought that it would be pretty clear that the British would be on his side, at least in that regard. And they start fighting. You remember when Poland was invaded in 1939, that very day, September 1st, the Germans invaded from the north. The Soviets invaded from the southeast. The very same day, and no one mentioned it.
Mm-hmm.
They both invaded at the exact same time because it was planned. You know, they were allies at the time. You know, at least they were trading at the time. And they invaded the country at the same time. So they allegedly go to war over Germany's invasion of Poland, but have nothing to say of Stalin's invasion of Poland on the very same day from a different direction. So the whole thing was a setup. The whole thing was phony to begin with. None of this is – everything you read in these books on the Cold War is false, because it's based on the argument that they were enemies, and that's impossible. They couldn't have been enemies making that much money over there, not for so long.
Could it be Hitler made the mistake of thinking that ideology actually matters, and he was dealing with sort of cold pragmatists?
You know, one of the funniest things Hitler ever said was when he invaded the Low Countries, because he needed to block. I mean, he realized he wasn't going to win this, that he wasn't going to get the English on his side. He offered to use German troops to defend the British Empire. And they still, of course, as you know, they sent Rudolf Hess into prison and everything. And getting the Low Countries, you know, making sure he had his proper governments in these countries, a way to keep the Allies out, because they were leaning toward Britain at the time. The British condemned him for rejecting their sovereignty. And he says, are you guys kidding me? You have the largest empire in the world. You control 3/4 of the planet and you're complaining to me? We have no colonies, by the way. And you're going to condemn us for self-determination? So this is why, and Hitler got, the only time he ever really got funny in his speeches when he gets sarcastic with the British, and they were condemning his attack on national sovereignty by invading some of these places, even before Poland. And the only time, because it was so ridiculous, they would do anything to fight him. They knew that he wasn't going to get them on his side, no matter how ridiculous it was in his mind that he, yeah, an ideology had absolutely nothing to do with it. Not until the 50s or even the 60s, you had nobody in the West who knew anything about Russia. The white armies, when they immigrated to the West, they didn't learn English. They had the FBI always on their tail after the war. Gerald Ford wouldn't meet with Solzhenitsyn so as to avoid irritating Brezhnev. So they bring some of these liberal dissidents over could kind of take his place. They always hated him. I actually have Solzhenitsyn's FBI file, and which I think is public now. All these guys, all these whites, the white forces that emigrated to the West, all had FBI tails. The communists didn't, but the whites did, and because they were considered sympathetic to Hitler, which, of course, pretty much all of them were, and including the Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. I'm working on something now, translating all of their praise for Hitler politically and everything else. We need a Hitler in Russia, words like that. So, you know, the whole thing is phony. Any book on the Cold War starts off with a completely false argument, and that somehow they're enemies. And really, the banks are the only things that really matter economically in the West. And the banks loved the idea because the banks were heavily invested in the USSR. And Trotsky says he says the stupidest things, because when it came to actual policy, Lenin, Stalin, and Trotsky were exactly the same. They were absolutely as vicious, as single-minded. Only when Trotsky went in exile did he start condemning Stalinism. But he was no different when he was head of the Red Army during the Civil War. He had far more power than Lenin did, because he was going back and forth to New York City. Remember, you know, Karl Marx was working for the New York Daily News. Trotsky was working for a major American newspaper. I mean, these guys all had jobs in the American press at one point. They all did. People forget that Karl Marx was working for the American media. These people either simply didn't know, didn't understand, or didn't care. But knowledge about Russia, knowledge of what Bolshevism actually was a handful of specialists in the West had any idea what they were talking about. All they knew that this was a strong state that they always had to use to keep Germany under control after World War I. That's all they cared about. That's all they saw. And everything else they didn't care about. And this is why the West was able to support them. They would not have lasted a year had Woodrow Wilson not released all the wheat. You know, Russia was one of the – Russia fed the planet under Tsar Nicholas. Now they can't grow anything. And only recently have they been able to feed themselves. Again, after all these years, they were feeding the entire planet. Russian grain, you know, shipments were humongous. And once the Soviets take over, they're starving. And because they weren't paying anything for the grain deliveries from farmers, so they end up stop delivering. And that's where the attacks on the peasantry come from. And they support nationalists in Ukraine and places like that. And that's what they knew. Even if they wiped out every peasant in the land, that they would get money from the West, that they'd get wheat and all the aid they needed from the West. They were rescued over and over again. In the 70s, they were rescued by, actually in the 60s, I should say, they were rescued by Archer Daniels Midland and their predecessor companies. who were selling them at absolute incredibly low rates wheat after the Virgin Lands disaster of Khrushchev, yeah, they should have been wiped out 1,000 times over if it wasn't for aid and trade and assistance from the West right up until the 1970s.
In the book, you discuss the myths leading up to the revolution about what Russia wasn't really ripe for revolution. It was the Great War that created the conditions, but also the myths regarding Grigory Rasputin. You want to expound on that?
This is something I've really gotten into only the last decade or so. Like a lot of people, I thought he was this demonic influence, and he was nothing of the kind. No one ever said anything that he wasn't just an Orthodox monk from someplace, from his village in Siberia, because they sent the cops there, to his village, to get dirt on him, and they got nothing. He didn't want any political power. He was almost never at the palace. He was never with either the Tsar or the Tsarina near the end. He only showed up when Alexei was bleeding to death, and he had this tremendous ability, which no one's been able to figure out, which was grace. I mean, there's all these church groups in Russia that have canonized him because there's no explanation for what he was able to do. You can't hypnotize someone to stop bleeding. And that's pretty much the only thing that they have. So he was a channel for grace, and the only reason that Alexei ever survived. He didn't want power. He wanted to go back to Siberia more than anything else, but they kept him in Petersburg because of his abilities. And ultimately, the monarchy's enemies began to realize that you can't attack Nicholas directly. You couldn't do that legally, although the left did it all the time. But it eventually would get you into trouble. But he was just too damn popular. So then they switched tactics and started attacking this Rasputin. The communist newspapers, which were never shut down, by the way, communist newspapers, the leftist newspapers, all invented this whole story that this guy was running the country. He was deciding which bishops go where. None of this is true. He didn't want power. He didn't want a target on him. He did have a double. That is the source of some of these police stories. These police stories do not have signatures. I mentioned in the book the emergency inquiry that the white government, the government of Kerensky, had issued this committee to look into corruption in Tsar Nicholas's government, including Rasputin. Now, these are enemies of the monarchy, right? They had just overthrown him. Remember, the white armies were liberals. I mean, they had monarchists in them, but these guys were all working for the whites. They had no ruling ideology, really. These weren't monarchists. None of them were. So the white government under Kerensky issued this emergency committee of inquiry, looking in, and they on every piece of paper, everything that government ever put out, they looked over, and they could find nothing. There was no government less corrupt than the one under Alexander III and Tsar Nicholas, his son. And of course, they did everything they could to pin something on Rasputin. And I have quotations in there that have never seen the light of day in English before, where they come back saying, we got nothing on him. He was not looking for power. He didn't have power. He definitely had a double. Because, he looked like a typical Russian peasant anyway. That wasn't hard to do. He was not involved in any kind of sexuality. The one woman that they said he raped was still a virgin when they examined her. He wanted to go home. He had a family that he wasn't in contact with, but they demanded he stay there. He wanted nothing to do with any kind of power whatsoever. And he was one of the few. And the other reason that he was attacked in the West, the British intelligence figured out that he was the one voice, the only kind of political opinion he ever had, was for Russia to stay out of World War I. And because you're not going to survive this. He was one of the few people who figured out that this was going to be a war like no other war ever, with machine guns and gas and development of the tank, development of air power. No war is going to be like this. And Rasputin seemed to have this penetrating insight as he was trying to go home, saying, don't get involved in this. But of course, the whole British strategy was to have Germany and Russia fight each other, because that was the only way Britain could ever win. They couldn't take them on, certainly as a combination. But those were the two big threats to British hegemony, were Germany and Russia, for very similar ways. And they were trading very heavily with each other. Wilhelm II and Nicholas were first cousins. They weren't going to kill each other. So they had to create, and the weak point, of course, was in the Balkans, because Austria-Hungary had a treaty with Germany. The British figured out, okay, if we could create a cause for war in the Balkans, we can use these treaties to get them fighting each other, because we're not going to win if they combine to form one alliance, which they would have, because they had far more in common. And so that was the whole point of British strategy, was to get their two big allies, their two big enemies, their two big rivals to fight one another. And that's what World War I was, using Austria ultimately and their hatred for Serbs as the nodal point. So this is what World War I was. And of course, I pulled it off with the typical diabolical brilliance that only the Rothschilds can do. And Nicholas knew that this was going to be a problem. He didn't want to mobilize his forces. So the British government eventually killed him. And these upper class elites, who didn't like Nicholas either, were hired to kill him. And he didn't have a super, he died of normal causes. All the stories of him, being shot and stabbed and poisoned, having nothing happen to him, this is all mostly mythology. So the stories about Rasputin were false. When you have the revolutionary government of Kerensky looking into this, reading every piece of paper they can get their hands on and saying, we have nothing on this guy, he's done nothing wrong. And then at least Kerensky had the honesty to publish it. But you better read Russian, because as far as I can see, I can't find an English language version of this, because it was a multi-volume work that they eventually published before they fell that had all of this. And so the stuff that you read about Rasputin, every syllable of it is wrong. This has already been taken care of. No one in Russia thinks that he's a bad guy, including the Communist Party. So, that came from British interests and their invention of him, because no one spoke Russian. So, it's Johnson's Law again. They figured they could say anything they want. And, well, Russians are weird anyway, so it's probably true, which is what the average person thinks about Russia anyway. So that's where the Rasputin issue comes from. It comes from British intelligence. They needed to get rid of him. They needed to get rid of, ultimately, hopefully these two countries are going to kill each other, and then the British will rule, and Hitler comes around and destroys the entire plan. And so it was a shame, because, Germany and Russia have so much – Dugin says this all the time. Germany and Russia have so much in common. They had so much politically and economically in common at the time. They're two land powers. It took just diabolical brilliance to get them to start shooting at each other. But they found that key nodal point. But domestically, it was to go after Rasputin, because he wanted Russia just to stay out. And he almost succeeded. The only political opinion he ever had. So that's the foundation of the stuff on Rasputin. But, of course, I get into it in much greater detail.
Mm-hmm. Now, you also, Yami, it's important you mentioned that World War One, the Great War, sort of being fomented by banking, Rothschild banking interests, and that creating the precipitous conditions in Russia, which would not have obtained if Russia were at peace. In fact, you pointed out in the book that Russia was making great progress materially going into the 20th century. But also the 1905 Russo-Japanese War was also fomented by an agent of Rothschild. That was one Jacob Schiff in New York. And so in both cases, you have high finance Jewish interests behind these wars, going after not only the royal family, but Russia itself as an Orthodox empire.
Well, this is true. I just did a broadcast on the war in Crimea in the 1850s, the very end of Nicholas I's life. The fact is that Russia was not backwards compared to any of their opponents. Russia almost had to fight the entire world, because Britain was bribing the Poles, bribing the Prussians, was bribing the Swedes, promising them the moon, and they almost did enter the war. And so when Alexander II came in after Nicholas I died, he signed the peace treaty, which really wasn't all that bad. They had to give up a little bit of Bessarabia, and that was about it. And that was canceled, the Treaty of San Stefano, anyway. So they didn't even lose it. The British didn't take Sevastopol. The Russians just went from one side of the city to the other. That was all that happened. Russo-Japanese War was a problem, because the entire Imperial Japanese Navy came from the British, that were giving them surplus ships, that were building their own factories in Japan with British money. And they knew that the defenses of the Far East hadn't been completed yet. There was only one railroad feeding the Far East, only one railroad feeding the Crimea, for that matter. So getting supplies there took a long time. And the Russian Navy had to go around the entire world to get to the Far East. By that time, the war was over. And the Russian press, and then which was, you know, quickly became the American press, acted like this was this massive defeat. The Russian press was far freer in Russia at that time than the American press ever was, because they would condemn everything, even Russian, but most of the Crimean War was victory, especially against the Turks. And they treated everything as a massive defeat. And it's almost like, you know, your typical academic in Russian history is just a supporter of the white, you know, Kerenskian view of things. The Japanese Navy was financed entirely by Britain. Russia, during the Japanese Russo-Japanese War, was maybe 5% mobilized. The Japanese, when the peace treaty was signed in New Hampshire, said we were exhausted. We're at 110% mobilization here. We can't last anymore. And it's almost as if the Russian government began believing their own press, saying that they're losing. In fact, they weren't. But supplies, you know, Port Arthur was a surprise attack. The guns hadn't even been put together yet. And so the Japanese had an interest in taking all this English money, and most of these ships were being piloted by British captains anyway. And the same thing for the Turks during the Crimean War, all had either British or French captains. So it was even more than financing it. They actually led these forces. So that was your first, you know, the Russians were challenging the British in Central Asia. They were challenging them in the Far East. So the Russians supported the Chinese, and the British then supported the Japanese. And so much of this, you know, Japanese industrialization came from these loan credits and grants and naval support from the British Empire, and all this money being released by the Rothschild clan to build up the Japanese to the point they got them involved in a war that they couldn't win. And the Japanese said this when they signed the treaty. But the Russians didn't actually lose anything. They just stopped the fighting. And partially they had to stop the fighting because it was the press was so bad that the average Russian is thinking that they're losing. And it wasn't the case. It was a problem with supplies and the massive distances that they had to go from the industrialized areas all the way out to the Far East, which is, you know, like two Americas. And over some very difficult territory. And these guns were not even ready. They didn't have these fortresses built yet. Even in Crimea, you had a similar problem. These had just been taken from the Turks. And so you had Russia at a terrible disadvantage in both wars. But in terms of industry, you know, Prussia and Russia were very similar. They both had powerful scientific establishments. They were cooperating with each other substantially. And this is when the British start getting upset and had to create World War I, because, you know, the British thought, well, maybe the revolution of 1905 is going to work. It didn't. But even during World War I, the Russian economy grew. This notion of them not being able to supply military men is pure mythology. That the rifles were inferior is pure mythology. The story was that the Russian rifles were smoothbore and the British rifles were rifled. We get the word rifle from, you know, the spiral, carving on the inside of the barrel, which of course made it far more accurate. The problem was that the rifled guns took 60 seconds to get a shot off. You get three shots off with a smoothbore. And so that's why three quarters of the Allied forces were using smoothbores in Crimea. So it had nothing to do with being backwards. It has to do with simply a decision that the military made. And of course, Russia, Germany, no group was going to be dominant on sea like the British were. That was their whole thing. So that they certainly were inferior by, but that was about it. So all the stories about Russia not being able to supply its men, everybody had that problem in 1914 and early 1915. Russia very quickly recovered, just like Germany. No one expected the war to be this bad. No one expected it to be as destructive as it was. No one was prepared for this, the level of industrial production that was necessary to supply the war. So everyone had those problems. All these governments ended up falling, except the British, of course. So, you know, again, it's just one myth after another, and none of this stuff is in English. So it's all up to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting to point out that during World War II, of course, with now the Bolsheviks in control of Russia, and as you say, more or less proxies of the West to get control of the West, I mean, to get control of the Russian resources and economy, that at that point, Japanese power, which had been built up for decades by the West. The Japanese became a power in the Pacific in the 1930s and 40s, largely because of Western aid and support and credit and technology. And then when the Japanese could be used as a bulwark to contain communism, the United States went to war against Japan, and allowing the expansion of communism eventually into China.
Well, what a crazy coincidence. But the minute Japan became, of course, very anti-Soviet, they were the bloc against Stalin in the far – well, against Lenin in the Far East. The Japanese army was in a position to crush the Soviets in the East, and they were threatened by the British. No more money from us if you mess with them. And the Japanese were told to back off. But the minute that they were too big for their britches, all of a sudden, you know, they become the enemy. They went from the noble Aryans of the East to savages overnight in the Western world. And the same thing goes for Germany. You know, they love the idea of the Russians and Germans killing each other. For as far as the British were, and then the Americans were concerned, that was a great idea because it guaranteed their dominance. But then Hitler got way too big for British comfort. And since the British had tremendous influence in the Soviet Union, it was a done deal that Germany was going to be the enemy. So, but that wasn't a change as far as British policy was concerned. They were the savage Huns who killed babies for no reason, and which actually was a propaganda line. That really didn't change. But they loved the idea of them killing each other. When there was a concept that they actually may be able to overthrow the Soviet Union. And then, you know, Lend-Lease develops and everything else, knowing full well that they'd have Ukraine on their side, they'd have the Baltics on their side, they'd have the Belarusians on their side, they'd have most Russians on their side. All of a sudden, the money just pours in. And if it wasn't for Western aid, they couldn't have won the war. So it was this balancing act that had nothing to do with ideology whatsoever. It was just who's useful, who needs our aid the most, and that's who we could use against our opponents. And then the Americans just took over from where the British left off.
Trotskyism, Stalinism, and the West. You offer a revisionist critique of these things. How did Trotskyism differ from Stalinism, and what were the relationship between these two isms to the West?
Well, whenever you could find a difference, let me know, because I can't find one. Trotsky has a book out, Terrorism and Revolution. And he talks about all the things that he would later condemn Stalin for as a part of his agenda. Terrorism and Communism, I'm sorry, was the name of the book. And, you know, he was a Stalinist. I mean, I don't know the differences, because even on the Jewish question, you know, Stalin was Trotsky was a Jewish nationalist. But as Solzhenitsyn says, it didn't matter if the old Bolsheviks were being purged. Stalin was still surrounded by Jews. And Solzhenitsyn spends a lot of time explaining just how the Jews benefited from Stalin's rule. Mm-hmm. The fact that these much older guys were Jews just has to do with the fact that it was a Jewish party. But that didn't change under Stalin. And so there is no ideological difference. They both believe Stalin – I mean, Trotsky went on and on about the necessity for state control over industry and everything else. But the minute he goes into exile, all of a sudden, his former ally now is this anti-Semite who hates Jews, you know, for no reason. And this is what became the Western view of him. And it was very convenient for that fact. So it was really hard to defend him after a while. They're even doing this with North Korea. The latest BBC documentary on North Korea is claiming that North Korea is now a fascist state that's taken down all of its portraits of Marx and Lenin, which isn't true. There were a couple of these that were taken down for cleaning, which they claimed are being taken down because there's no connection anymore. But of course, that was just temporary. They're still there. I've seen it. I can see it on YouTube right now. So they were down for cleaning and repainting. Because, you know, they're exposed to the elements and everything. And they said, oh, you see, they're taking them down because they're not communist anymore. So they're still defending it. But the whole concept is the same. We can't defend North Korea anymore. We have no interest in, you know, they're not a powerful enough economy. So, you know, we can't associate that with communism. So we'll claim now that they're fascist, just like Stalin was. So now it's okay for liberals to hate North Korea. Now, I also did a broadcast on my favorite Asian anti-communist leader, General Chung Hee Park, the man who took over from Syngman Rhee and took a fourth world, really one of the most impoverished countries in the world after Korea, and turned them into a first world industrial powerhouse in 10 years. There's only one other person that's done that. I mean, Hitler did it. Putin took a little bit longer to do it. But they took these broken countries and personally rebuilt them almost in a very short period of time. And Chung Hee Park was murdered by the CIA in 1979. And when Chung Hee Park was saying Hitler's one of my models, he said Hitler and Napoleon and Bismarck, I think, were the three main models that he had in rebuilding the South Korean economy. And he did, by the way, mint his own currency, the won, and didn't tell the West about it until the very last second because he knew that he'd be in trouble from that moment on. And so it became a state-run currency there. The U.S. tilted to North Korea for a while. I have an essay out on the USS Pueblo incident. And there were several attempts that were financed. But the guy who was eventually executed for shooting General Park admitted just the night before that he was at the U.S. ambassador's residence a few hours before he shot Park Chung-hee. And the only reason that the U.S. maintained troops there was because Park Chung-hee said, we're going to build our own nuclear arsenal, so we don't really need you anymore. We're more powerful than the North now, so we don't need you. And then to avoid that, they kept soldiers there because the North Korea was going to invade again after the end of the Vietnam War because they knew the U.S. wasn't going to come to his assistance. And that's when he said, okay, I got my own nukes in the works now, so I don't have to worry about it. And the U.S. said, oh, nope, it's okay, we'll stay. And so the invasion never happened. So they did the exact same thing. You know, the U.S. was pro-North for a while in the late 60s and through most of the 70s because Park Chung-hee just simply did what Hitler did economically and was condemning the U.S. for rejecting him and giving him faulty information. And when he discovered the tunnels under from the North to the South, which had to have been done with U.S. Knowledge, he said, okay, I need to centralize power and rebuild the army, which he did and was condemned by the U.S. for it. So this is nothing new. For all the condemnation of North Korea, it's easy to forget that the U.S. was pro-North throughout the period of time when the military took over South Korea and in 10 years took it from the poorest country in the world to one of the richest in this very brief period of time, partially by minting his own currency and partially by – and he knew that it was over. He only let the news out the day before he was going to announce it, because the Federal Reserve had, prior to that, controlled the Korean currency. So when the won was minted, he knew that he wasn't going to be in a lot of trouble. So he controlled how that press was going to be done. And from there on in, they called him a monster and everything else. And that's when he pulled his men out of Vietnam, because he had 100,000 men supporting the U.S. in South Vietnam. So the policy goes back. So this is, you know, think that the U.S. is this anti-communist element isn't true. It all has to do with self-interest, and Hitler is the main boogeyman no matter what's going on. So I don't care what part of the world you go to, it's the exact same process.
And, of course, that whole situation in Asia, whether it's Vietnam or Korea, was set up after the war, you know, with the North and South being set up. Obviously the North is given over to the Reds, the communists, and then the same thing, Vietnam being divided, and then, you know, the whole thing in the 50s with the French and Bien de Phu, and then us kind of nudging the French out and then not signing the accords, but, you know, that called for a unified election. And then this creates the pretext for the Vietnam War and all the money that's made from that, not to mention just the sort of the strategy of tension, the psychological, you know, effect of these wars particularly on the American public. Korea itself was a justification for unilateral presidential war making, and then UN and this sort of a step towards global governors. Was there a Dean Acheson that said Korea saved us? It kind of got the Cold War funded, because that was the crisis that got the Cold War funded. Because prior to that, there's real resistance in Congress and Capitol Hill for the Truman Program. And then after that, the Cold War became a bipartisan thing. Would you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I would, because one of the reasons that the North invaded the South is that they were told that this is outside of the American sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. They gave no assistance to Sigmund Rhee, who was, by the way, educated in America. My family actually housed him when he was at Princeton. He was in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, living there for a brief period of time when he was finishing his doctoral degree at Princeton. Sigmund Rhee, who eventually took over the government in South Korea and was overthrown by General Park. So I actually have a personal connection, because this is before I was born, but he actually lived in my family's hotel in Ocean Grove for a while. And even there, they said this is a very, very gentle man who couldn't come down on the communists the way that the military wanted. And they were taking advantage of him, and corruption snuck in because they were, you know, he was too gentle of a guy, so the military eventually overthrew him, claiming that he was sympathetic to them. And the fact is that's not true. He was just way too decent of a man for Korean politics at the time. So they're telling the North that, you know, do what you want. We don't care about South Korea. You can see we're not spending any money there. They have nothing in terms of military power. Then they invade because they're essentially invited to it. Like the U.S. is going to get involved in another war 5 years after World War II with all the demobilization. And that's exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, they retire Douglas MacArthur, and they humiliated him, even though he actually won that exchange because Truman was such an idiot. But still, you know, that did save this whole concept, even though most people don't know what the Korean War was.
Yeah, but it's the forgotten war, and they like it that way.
Yeah, that's right. My father was a veteran. My father lost part of his left hand there.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's a big deal in my family, and no one really cares. And it wasn't like – at least you didn't have the contempt for the military like you had during Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, once anti-communist governments, either military governments like in Iraq or religious governments like in Afghanistan – are the targets, all of a sudden the military are these wonderful heroes, because it's – and the Communist Party was banned in every one of these countries. They didn't have support because so much of their issues were stolen by the governments anyway, which is what happened in South Korea. You know, they had – you know, the South Korean case continues to intrigue me here, because they had employment for life in most of these factories. The South Korean military government built every hospital, every university comes from these guys. What were they protesting against? What could another government do better? You know, these people had jobs and became elites and middle class only because the military government took over and ultimately threw all the economic elites in prison, saying, I'll let you out when you agree to play ball, which is exactly what happened, which irritated the Americans. And so, you know, for this period of time, as South Korea is exploding, it's not being done because they had some free trade agreement with the U.S. It's being done because everything was financed internally. They didn't want this massive trade with the U.S. They got it anyway because they were aware that South Korea had that one ace in the hole, and that is to build their own nuclear arsenal. And they couldn't have this, so they stayed, and that's why they're there today. Although there's no military government there, and there's no – I guess Chun Doo-hwan was the last one, also assassinated by the Americans. So they were doing the North's job for it. So as far as Korea goes, all of a sudden, yeah, the Cold War becomes this issue. And but even the American media was saying, isn't this weird? We could have sworn they said that invading the South wasn't a problem. And the fact that the North even would ask the U.S. about this issue. I mean, they went to Stalin too. But they have said to the U.S., you sure you got no problem with this? And they said, nope, go ahead. Saddam Hussein said the same thing about Kuwait just before the war. April Glaspie was the ambassador who said, oh, no, it's fine. We don't really give a damn. It's a monarchy. So in both cases, you have this almost permission to invade, and all of a sudden it becomes this war. And they had a draft back then in Korea. But, you know, because of the contempt that's thrown on North Korea now, it's hard for Americans to realize that the U.S. supported the North for a long time. So long as the South Korean government was as successful as it was as a nationalist state that had very strong racial – you try to immigrate to South Korea, see how well you do. They have racial laws in place. So does the North, by the way. They have very strict racial laws in place. The Japanese still do. They won't take any of these migrants from North Africa. So, you know, everything that the average educated American believes about the world is false. That's the ultimate argument of the book.
And also, of course, the Security Council decision for the UN operation in Korea in 1950, the Soviet Union was conveniently missing, right? They walked out.
They had resigned because of this and then rejoined immediately after that. So, yeah, it's very convenient. But, you know, they still were the main, you know, North Korea wasn't a Chinese client state. It was a Soviet client state. Mm-hmm. Back then, it didn't matter.
No, because before the split, yeah.
But that was before the split. And, of course, the Chinese were the ones who invaded. My father never saw a North Korean. He only saw 8th Route Army guys from China. They're experienced people. The other thing that he testified about that no one listened to him was their use of child soldiers. The Chinese in Korea, especially with their 1st Marine Division, which he was a part of, which was really the big unit that frightened them. And the 8th Route Army was the elite of the Chinese. But Communist China was a brand new country in 1950.
Yep.
They invaded a short time after. And their strategy was, you know, the Marines would set up a position and they'd have barbed wire and mines and they'd hang grenades from the barbed wire. They would send children. They inspected the battlefield there. These were children with no weapons in some cases. No supplies. These would be gunned down. They would set off the mines. They would weigh down the barbed wire. And then when the 50 calibers, my father was a BAR guy, when these overheated, then the actual soldiers came over. And they would step on the bodies that had been weighing down the barbed wire. And that's how they drove the U.S. into the ocean. That's how they did it. And the Marines at the time, they were screaming this for years. These guys are in their late 80s now, but no one listened to them. And no one in talking about the Korean War will talk about their use, the deliberate slaughter of children that the Marines then had to deal with after that. And I don't know what they told these kids, either that their families were threatened or that the Americans or cowards are going to run away immediately or something like that. But that's how they won this war. And there was no mention of this. Look, any book on the Korean War you could ever find will not mention it. Despite the fact that Marines were saying this, they said it to Congress, they said it all over the place, this is how they were winning these battles and taking huge casualties. The casualty numbers that you see on Wikipedia are, you know, 8 to 10 times less than what they really were. The Chinese weren't going to report this, that they were using these swarm techniques all the time. So even then, the media was covering for them. The historical establishment was covering for them. That this would have been a big deal, and this would have been a big issue. At any other time. And even then, it would have been a big issue that this is how the Chinese operated on the battlefield. This is exactly how they did operate. And when you had, you know, witnesses saying this, because all the 1st Marine Division guys were saying this at the time, and it was being covered up. And these are some of the things, even that Joe McCarthy was going to mention, he never got a chance to. How can that be? Why is the U.S. government not talking about this, or even the media talk? This would be a pretty big story. And it didn't matter. It was one of these things, one of these open secrets that were covered up. Just like everything during the Cold War, always to the benefit of the communists.
Yeah, that also reminds me that during the Korean War, Truman ordered, I think it was the 7th Fleet in between Formosa and China, ostensibly to protect Formosa from invasion from the mainland, but it's quite the opposite because Chiang Kai-shek offered to invade China. After the Chinese invaded Korea, went over the border, the Yalu River. But the interdiction there prevented Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist forces from attacking from the east. So there's no coordination there. But it's interesting, again, this ostensibly it's done to protect Formosa because China had no capacity to invade from the sea, whereas Formosa did. So that's another example of them sort of aiding the communist forces, prolonging the war and extending the crisis out another year or so.
I'm pretty sure I mentioned that because even when the Thai army was involved in Vietnam, the South Koreans sent their elite men. They sent the Capital Division and the National Division over, and they scared the crap out of the North Vietnamese. because they didn't have any rules of engagement. They just said, we shoot them when we see them. We don't care. And, well, the U.S. did not have that kind of freedom. And yet, Chung Hee Park pulls them out. I actually spoke to the daughter of the commander, sorry, the granddaughter of the South Korean commander in Vietnam, whose name I can't think of off the top of my head. And she, who's politically liberal, by the way, she says it was outrageous what they did to this man. They accused him of every crime. He was protected by the military government, of course. But they accused him of every crime. The same government that is promoting this war in Vietnam is condemning the people who actually fought it. They repressed the ARVN. They wouldn't allow the South Koreans to fight. They wouldn't allow the Thais to fight, even though all told, they had like 1.5 million men total in South Vietnam, and they still lose. That has to be done on purpose. And so it started with Chiang Kai-shek, who knew the language, who knew their weaknesses, who knew exactly how to attack them, who had offered to support the Americans during the Korean War after the Chinese invasion, that he knew how fragile that government was. They had just taken over. This is 1 year later. They took over in 49. This is 50, 51. And he could have retaken it again. And he had the men, he had the air power, and it was his reason that the Chinese never invaded, because they were never going to win from the air. They couldn't win from the sea. They always had the economic superiority on Taiwan. And then they accuse the South Koreans of all these massacres, which I deal with in other works, the Bodo League massacre and all this stuff that never happened, anything to humiliate them. And I have an essay on the USS Pueblo, who they send as a spy mission right off the North Korean coast, and they called it a low risk mission. So they went out there with no weapons whatsoever. They couldn't defend themselves. Then there was an assassination attempt on Chung Hee Park. They don't mention that to them. And then when they come under attack, the captain, who went to his grave condemning the U.S. on this, contacted the nearest aircraft carrier, which is about 200 miles away, which is nothing for them. And he said, can you please help us? We come under attack. And they say, no. And they said, but you're an aircraft carrier. He said, yeah, we're not, combat ready. And he said, well, what are you there for? you're 200 miles away from us. And you could find the captain, his interviews are still, he died recently, they're still online, saying that this was a setup. They had one shredder. So when they were boarded, they start shredding. They find that they only have one damn shredder. They didn't have a single weapon on board. They had a frozen 50 caliber machine gun that no one knew how to use. And they send them right off the coast of North Korea with all kinds of classified information that they knew was going to be taken. They give them no shredders, or one shredder, which wasn't a hundredth of what they needed. And North Korea got all of these spy secrets from the U.S. that were deliberately given over, called a low risk, and they call the aircraft carrier. I mean, how long does it take to go 200 miles and for one of these jets? And they said, no, sorry, we can't help you. And so the whole thing was an obvious setup. One of my favorite stories from this was after they were captured, they weren't treated that badly because they were worried about their image. But then the captives in their pictures were given the middle finger they didn't know what that meant. And you can see the pictures even today. They're kind of like resting their hands, had their heads in their hand, giving them the finger and everything. And the North Koreans said, what the hell does that mean? And they said, oh, it's just a Hawaiian good luck symbol. And they let them do it because they didn't know what it was. Time magazine, the very next week, gets these pictures and has a little box with a picture explaining the whole thing, what the middle finger is underneath it, knowing full well.
So they'll get, yeah.
And they were tortured so badly that one of them almost lost his sight. One died. And of course, they confronted Time magazine, who was very arrogant about it afterwards. They said, what American doesn't know what the middle finger is? You didn't need to explain that. You knew the North Koreans were watching every media reaction. You knew they were going to read that. You did it just to get rid of us, because we were going to come back and say it was a setup, and they all did. But if the media isn't on your side, it doesn't matter. So they knew no American needs to be told what that is. And they said, what are you doing? You deliberately did that because you knew that they would probably kill us. And they only killed one of them. But, the torture only started. They weren't treated that badly. The torture only started when that finally was read by the translators in North Korea. And there's a movie on the topic from years ago. And so this is how close the American press was working with the North Koreans. And, you know, and it doesn't matter. You had all these guys coming back to America all messed up. And they went right after Time magazine and they realized what had happened. And of course, if the American press doesn't pick it up, then it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So that's what Time magazine was doing. So in 1950, whatever year this was, it was late 60s.
68, I think.
I think so.
It was a year after the Liberty, by the way, Liberty incident. So.
Yeah, and not too dissimilar.
Yeah.
Because again, if the press isn't going to talk about it, then it didn't happen. And there's just a handful of the veterans, you know, who are dying off now, screaming at the top of their lungs, just like the Marines were doing all this stuff. This stuff, you had people talking about this all the time, but the press won't talk about it. But these are the things that when you put them all together, you say, my God, the U.S. supported Marxism all over the place, depending on who was running these. And they, you know, they didn't support any of the anti-communist military governments. I have another book, my most recent, on the military governments of Latin America, which, by the way, does not exist. No one has defended these governments, whether it be from, and it's not just Pinochet, but Velasco from Peru, Juan Perón, of course, all these guys, all these anti-communist governments taken as a unit, Somoza in Nicaragua, the El Salvador government that was condemned all over the place during the 1980s. I deal with them all there. And the U.S. condemned every last one of them. But you know, try to search for this online. You're not going to find any defense of these guys, not even in Spanish. And so I wrote a book, putting it all together, that the U.S. was actively supporting the communist movement in El Salvador throughout the 1980s. No matter what Ronald Reagan did, the American press, American private industry, was supporting the Marxists all over the place. And even the Church of Rome, all throughout Central Asia, was supporting liberation theology, which is what these guys were backing, at least temporarily. And in every one of these cases, these military governments usually nationalized Western businesses far more. They nationalized more industry than the communists ever even said they were going to nationalize. So the U.S. had no reason to support them. And that's a big talking point for the American left that, oh, the U.S. supported all these military dictators all over the place. No, they tried to destroy military dictators all over the place. Under the Carter administration, Pinochet wasn't allowed to visit the U.S. His passport was revoked. So this is everything. Everything that the average educated American believes about the world is false. Everything. There isn't anything you could tell me that you're not going to read about in a university or at a university program that isn't a complete a nonsense myth that's not that hard to destroy. And it's the reason I'm not an academic today. And it's a shame, but all of this is false. The U.S. was, while of course fighting Marxism whenever the empire got too big, and it usually had nothing to do with Marxism as such. It had, you know, any empire gotten that big would have been a problem. Supported it in every other way, especially private industry, who was supposed to be so terrified of Marxism, was too busy investing in communist countries and condemning these military governments all over the place, who actually were high-minded idealists. I have something on the Greek military government. I have something on not only in World War II, but in the right up until the 1970s. The anti-communist colonels, you know, up to the 70s, everything that's being said about them isn't true. Pinochet, our people know a bit more because he became such an issue, but they don't know about Somoza. They don't know about Batista, that he had far more social justice stuff going on in Cuba than Castro ever did. He was not some capitalist, a billionaire like they tried to claim. It's all false. And now this book only deals with that on the fringes. This is the core of a far bigger research agenda, that everything that Americans think about the Cold War is a deliberate lie. It's not just false. It's deliberately created and explained as a lie.
Well, it gets into your core argument, I think, is that that Marxist-Leninism as an ideology is useful for capitalists for penetrating or taking over some of these countries, whether it be Russia or Cuba or China, and these things in the long term, meaning it's much easier to deal with a monopolized, centrally controlled planned economy than it is to deal perhaps with a country that's nationalized, protects its interests, and pursuing its own economic nationalist interests, something that Park did in South Korea, which he had to be assassinated for, and brought, you know, the country had to be brought into line, you know, after he got sort of uppity with the currency. And you make the point in the book that how, yeah, you have Marxist ideology and you have capitalism and these things, and again, these ideologies don't really matter at the end of the day to the I guess to the international transnational banking interests, the oligarchs, and you draw a comparison between the West and the East, so to speak. Use that you know, that distinction, that communism and capitalism are both materialist ideologies. And can you expand on that?
You know, Solzhenitsyn was the first one back in the 60s. It would actually be probably in the late 70s, come to think of it.
Was that Harvard speech he made that point?
He starts it there, but yeah. He doesn't give the list. And I expanded on it. That Harvard speech is that all of a sudden, you know, he wasn't this Nobel Prize winning author anymore. He was not on anyone's list at that point. He was no longer a celebrity, because then he turned his guns on the West, saying, well, you guys are no different. Capitalism and communism are identical in almost every respect. They're both materialist ideologies. They both claim to have the key to history. They both claim to be the end of history. They both claim to be the fulfillment of the Enlightenment. They both put their faith in technology and industry. They're both completely secular, if not completely atheist. They both believe that economic production is the key to justice and truth, that economics is the proper way to think of the world, that they both believe in the separation of church and state. They both don't want any family structure to get in the way of their agenda. They both are completely, at least early on in the Soviet Union, they were sexually liberated, but that ended. So the stuff that was too radical for Trotsky is now public policy in the U.S. today, because the Soviets, because all of a sudden people aren't showing up to work once abortion was made legal, and you know, divorces were easy to get. You couldn't get a church marriage or anything, so then and no one had to take care of the kids, and people aren't showing up to work. There's nothing but decadence. So even Lenin had to end it. So the stuff that was too radical for Lenin and Stalin is now day-to-day public policy in America. That was Alexander Kollontai, who was the health minister.
I think she made the remark that she wanted to make sex as casual as drinking a glass of water. And Lenin's response was, "Who wants to drink out of a dirty glass?"
Yeah, because Marx made the comment that family is the first division of labor and it's exploitative and everything else. That technically they believed it, but only in theory. They didn't believe it in practice, because once they realized the decadence that
things fall apart. Yeah.
Things fell apart. People aren't showing up to work. No one's taking care of the kids. The next generation has no one looking after them. They had to stop it. So that was the only reason for that, though. But that was just it. They the same exploitation that capitalism does, you know, impose on labor, the communists were far worse. It was identical in almost every way. The only difference is that in the Soviet Union, the state and capital were the same. In the U.S., the state and capital are different. I mean, one controls the other today, but that wasn't always the case. That, as far as I can see, that's the only real difference that they have. The West, I guess another one would be that the West controls people psychologically.
Yes, yeah.
By how they think. The Soviets were way too crude in how they tried to control people. They never won over hearts and minds like the West has.
The Soviet system oppressed. The West seduces, yeah.
Exactly right. Yeah, having a machine gun on every roof is no way to control a population. You can't keep that up for long. You know, the Soviet press, they would condemn something to the skies, but they would tell the truth about it. They would editorialize about it. The U.S. will cover it up entirely.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've read so many back issues of Pravda. It's not bad journalism. The only thing that makes it a problem is that they editorialize about it, but they tell far more of the truth than the American press does. The American press just covers it up, and they're monopolies in both cases. They both ideologies lead to centralization, because the average, you know, huge American conglomerate is a planned economy. There are no markets. You know, markets are created by industry. They're not responded to. People buy what's in the stores, not what they want. So all of this, when you got this whole long list of similarities, you say, my God, they're extremely similar. And Solzhenitsyn started that list. I continue to add to it. Others have continued to add to it. In terms of basic ideology and fundamental assumptions about what a human being is, that a human being is nothing more than nerve endings that are just pleasure-seeking machines. That's pretty much all there is. And the Soviets were just simply cruder about how they went about imposing it. But the seduction of light industry capitalism or productive, you know, consumer capitalism is far easier to control people that way than the heavy industry focus of the Soviet Union. It was all way too crude. They never really won anybody over. There was just this class that had an interest in supporting the bureaucracy, and that was it. Otherwise, it was just a pretty much a non-stop, as Ivan Ilyin used to say, it was pretty much a low-level civil war throughout its entire existence. But those people, when they were exiled to America, were just as much persona non grata here as they were there, Solzhenitsyn included. After the Harvard speech, he was gone.
Yeah.
No one had anything to do with the guy. And he knew this. And he did have a huge FBI file. They tailed all these guys. And of course, they were delivering this information to the KGB, who wanted to kill him. So he had to be secretive with everybody in America. We don't even know what church he belonged to, because he didn't tell anybody. He knew that the U.S., if they found out, would give that information over. And so he didn't trust anybody. And to this day, you still in Russian churches, they don't to become one of them. Now, I did that back in grad school, and I was young at the time. To become one of them takes a lot of work, because they have no reason to trust anybody. There's some American that shows up out of nowhere. And a church that doesn't speak English, which is exactly what I did. You're going to be suspicious. I was only in my 20s. They did, you know. So I became – I had a key to the church at one point. But that takes a lot of work, and they do it because they knew that even allies of theirs had FBI tails and that this information was going to be shared, especially when detente came under Nixon and then under Ford. When detente came into existence, the U.S. was turning over this information, and these FBI files were being read by the KGB. And, of course, but these guys had taken precautionary measures to protect themselves, and part of that was not being a part of American society. They didn't learn English. Solzhenitsyn, of course, knew it. But generally speaking, all these guys, they could have been telling the world about what the Soviet Union was, but because they were isolated, deliberately being isolated, they never had a chance to. And that goes for Ukrainians as well as Russians throughout the Cold War. They had an army in this country that could have been telling the world about it. But because the U.S. was giving this information, when detente hit, the U.S. is giving this information over, so they didn't trust a soul. And that became the problem. That's why these guys didn't really speak very much. And that became a big problem, I think.
Hmm. Interesting, because, yeah, again, most people just accept the Cold War at face value, you know, capitalist West, free West versus the tyranny, communism of the East. But, you know, the moment, you know, obviously the research of Anthony Sutton, what you write about, is it's much more convoluted and complex than we're led to believe. It wasn't, you know, Black versus white or East versus West. As you learn more about how the world operates and learn more about history, you suspect that's how it would be. But I guess it was an attempt to sort of monopolize, take over the East through these subversive means and using war and revolution as a way of sort of capturing these markets and manipulating them, playing the game. I mean, obviously, from throughout the years, you're going to have to improvise and change a little bit to to adapt to changing circumstances. But if you look at what happened in China appears to be like a long-running sort of a Rockefeller plan, you know, that started in the turn of the century. And this goes back to the Opium Wars and how China now has been turned into sort of this factory, churning out all these goods that Americans think they need, buying with money they don't have. And this is the whole economic system. And it gets, you know, if you get into some of these meetings, you know, so how they talk about these things at Davos or at Bilderberg, and how these oligarchs talk about, you know, the changing geographics of production and how they're sort of trying to move the chess pieces on the world, you know, on the world stage, and engaging in, you know, fomenting a civil war here, starting a revolution here, then decades later using the cheap labor that arises from these conflicts to build a factory here, moving it out of the United States, a deindustrialization of the United States. It all seems to be part of a plan, you know, to just sort of reorganize the world and create sort of a global feudal system.
Well, you know, you mentioned the Opium Wars, and there you had China unifying under the Manchus, getting way too big to be brought under control. Now the Chinese have realized that, I mean, they're about as, you know, communist as I am. They're, that's, as Willis Carto used to say, it's a national socialist government. And that's pretty much how they function. Very racial, very Han-centered. And they realize that the Americans don't have the money that they used to. They're not as dependent on the American market like the American market is dependent on them, you know, creating these cheap goods. And then you have the Chinese doing their own outsourcing to Vietnam and Cambodia and you know, Thailand and places like that because their labor costs have gotten too high. Mm-hmm. So they've turned to the EU. They've turned to the developing world, certainly Russia. The sanctions put on China and the Trump administration, all that's ever meant is that the Chinese simply turn these contracts over to the Russians now. So it hasn't hurt them, just like sanctions on Russia hasn't. It's actually helped them. They now have all of their own they have their own credit processing systems now. And the Chinese are now a huge part of it. So that giant economy is lost because they realized that it was one thing when you had substantial credit. But after 2008, when that credit was wiped out, and you know, you can't get your dog can't get a credit card like they used to. God, I got thousands of dollars worth of credit before I had a job.
Yeah.
In the 90s. That's not the case anymore. And these people are being you can't keep bailing them out. The money eventually is going to run out. The inflationary pressure is going to get too much because the US doesn't produce anything. They're not going to have they have no more faith in the dollar. Because if they did, they wouldn't be dumping it everywhere. And so now you have a nationalist Chinese government in full military and economic union with Russia. But now it's too late. You know, the British won the Opium Wars. You know, as soon as the Chinese began winning its drug war, which it won in about a year, all of a sudden there's a war that breaks out. And you have it in the Philippines when President Duterte, who's one of my favorite human beings on the planet now, starts saying it's okay for addicts to start shooting their dealers. And all of a sudden, these dealers are now turning themselves in. The drug war's won. It's over. And now you, and the only reason that there's been no massive threats on Philippines is that they've allied with China. That gets strained now and again, but they've thrown the U.S. out of the country because they, you know, they're fighting him. They're doing it. He won his drug war. And so you, that guarantees you an invasion by the U.S. like it was in Afghanistan when the Taliban won their drug war in about a week in the late 90s. But the only thing that the Taliban didn't do was make an alliance with China or Russia for obvious reasons. The Filipinos did. So that kind of protects them to some extent. Same thing for Burma. So the Asian case is, you know, it's simply too late. The U.S. doesn't have the forces anymore. I've made fun of the U.S. military and the constant planes are always crashing and ships are crashing into fishing boats. Every other day, that's another scandal. Because the U.S. military has fallen to pieces. They have so many jobs to do with, you know, relatively few men, and there's no political will for a draft. You know, although it's true that the anti-war movement doesn't exist anymore, which is kind of odd, that it was so big in 1970, but it's non-existent now, and even though these wars are longer and far bloodier than the official casualty statistics will suggest, the Russian intelligence has exposed that. Far more Americans have been killed than people realize. Much more. They simply don't have the forces anymore. They don't have the money. They don't have the men. They don't have the political will. They certainly don't have the national unity that you would need for any protracted war. And you know, you have embedded journalists. So you know, the U.S. is in no position to threaten these countries anymore. It's not like it was in the Opium War era in the 19th century, where the British Empire could take the disorganized Chinese state on and win. So, you know, it's lost. You know, the U.S. has lost this war, which is why in the Bilderberg meetings, I don't see any Chinese names and I don't see any Russian names. I haven't seen any Russian or Chinese names. Every time I see this list of participants, I haven't seen a Russian name since when I attempted to infiltrate the meeting at the Westfields Marriott in Virginia in 2002, claiming to be a grad student from the University of Colorado. They didn't buy it, by the way. I got kicked out. I was there with Jim Tucker and and I almost got arrested actually because everyone was actually kicked out of there, but I went anyway. Chris Bolin and Jim Tucker and I were there, and me, and And so I tried to get in, but they didn't buy my story. So, but damn, they had a lot of security guys show up out of nowhere. So, but even in that list, which we found in a garbage can somewhere, there were no Russian names. Or maybe that was the last time there was a Russian name on there or a Chinese name on there. Because ever since then, I can't find one. So they've been kicked out of the global elite. They're simply not trusted anymore. There are Ukrainian names on there, if I remember right. But they've pretty much lost the battle with these two countries. So any countries that these two put their protection over ends up being easily protected. The U.S. trying to start a war with Russia and China at the same time. How is that going to end? Unless, of course, the purpose is for the U.S. to lose, which, of course, it will, and another far more powerful body to take over. But regardless, you know, the situation is very, very different. I was the first to say that Putin was an ally of the right wing. I was saying that in 2000, 2001, when I was at the Barnes Review. And everyone made fun of me. Everyone attacked me. Everyone said that he was just a communist, a KGB guy, all this stuff. And all of a sudden, I start converting people. And that's where that whole thing comes from.
Mm-hmm.
I started that. I was the first one to say it. I took so much crap for it at the time because the right wing was condemning Putin because of his KGB background. Then all of a sudden, I'm learning Russian at the time. And I'm starting to translate some of these articles saying, oh, my God, he's a right winger. And by any stretch of the imagination. And that the U.S., of course, is – you still have some of the old Cold War mentality in America in 99, 2000. But now the U.S. is the evil empire. It's no different than British Empire. It wasn't going to go in the same direction. There's simply no money. There's simply no credit like there was even in the 90s to support, a country like China to keep its dollars on board. Their trade now between Russia and China is done in yuan. It's not being done. It was done in dollars for decades. So what's going to happen when the demand for dollars collapses? Because they're selling dollars off by the ton. The Japanese can't keep buying them up, which is what they're doing. And then, of course, the biggest gold reserves are in Russia right now, who has a massive trade surplus. So what's going to happen?
Maybe you foment a rebellion in Hong Kong or something.
Oh, yeah, I wonder. They might be vaguely connected to it, yeah.
These things just tend to arise at certain times. And
yeah, all completely spontaneous.
So, well, Dr. Johnson, I want to thank you for coming back on the show. The book is The Soviet Experiment, Challenging the Apologists for Communist Tyranny. This is a series of articles, but it's a good revision of what we've been told of the 20th century about these defining and key moments. Nothing is the way we were told, and that's how we have to look at these things. It's a little disconcerting and can be confusing at first, but then you read works like yours, you start to get the idea of the bigger picture, and that's the first step in hopefully getting a government and representatives that actually can turn these things around, start developing or implementing policies that are more humane and in the interest of the American people, as opposed to the transnationalists, the bankers, special interest groups, Israel, the Israel lobby. Whoever thinks on top, I think it's sort of probably a consortium of elite interests, of various factions or gangs that are doing this. So I highly recommend the book. You have anything else to say?
Well, just to the group of people who have careers based on plagiarizing me, can you please just – all I ask for is a thank you. And these guys know who they are. They're probably listening. I always cite my sources. I always do. I never, steal. But there are people out there who steal from me all the time.
Nothing wrong with an attribution.
Yeah, just please, just mention my name one time. Just a thank you is all I'm looking for. And some of these guys are making money off stuff that I've done, and it kind of pisses me off. All I want is a thank you from you guys. I end up doing so much of the legwork and the translations and everything else, and then just get taken, and I hear a one- and two-syllable version of it from some of these guys, using the same terminology in some cases, the same arguments, either positive or negative. Just a thank you once in a while wouldn't kill you.
That's right. I mean, you cite Anthony Sutton when you cite his work.
And no one died.
Okay, well, listen, I'll let you go now. To have you for about an hour and a half, and we're coming up on that. I do. So people follow your work. What's the best place?
My website, rushjournal.org, is the best place to go. It has either has everything on there or has links to everything. Because I publish all of my stuff is everywhere. I always forget about it. I always forget where it is. It gets reprinted all over the place, and I publish things, but I always make sure I have a link to it there. I have a lot of stuff on that site, but if it's not there, I have a link to where it is. And all the stuff that we talked about, all the dozens of topics we talked about on this, just this one show, I have far more detailed analysis there. Mm-hmm. Both on there and as well as links. I mean, every issue of the Barnes Review, you know, it was 20 years ago, almost today, I got my job there. Willis Cardo took a chance on an unknown at the time. And I always promote the Barnes Review. You can't get this stuff online. The stuff that we published there is peer reviewed because I usually get these articles first. And it's first rate stuff. You can't get it anywhere else. I always promote it. The American Free Press. I really could use the money because this is what I do full time. Mm-hmm. I don't have any church backing me. I don't have any university, any think tank, any government, unlike my opponents who have all those things backing them. I have my readers and listeners. So on my site is a PayPal donation button, which I wouldn't mind you pushing. So I can continue to do this. Having no backing is good on the one hand, because I could do exactly what I want. And that's enviable. What's not enviable is that I actually have to eat.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you wouldn't help me eat, I would really appreciate it.
Okay, well, listen, thank you so much for coming back on the show.
It's my pleasure. You know that. We run a good website and a good podcast, and I really appreciate your work.
Thank you. And when I post this, I'll send you the link. I'll be posting it soon. I'll send you the link. So.